You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. And the Library Foundation of Los Angeles is instrumental in supporting many of the programs at the Los Angeles Public Library, from homework help to college prep to Read Baby Read. The list is long, and the programs are vital in giving access and support to Angelenos across this vast city. This season, we've focused on resilience. We've picked this idea for many reasons. Most importantly, it spoke to all of us that we've had to be resilient in order to survive these last 2 years. We've looked at resilience from many angles, using both fiction and nonfiction to focus on issues, characters, and people who have risen to the occasion, regardless of the circumstances that surround them. Tonight, we look at the thoughtfully conceived and crafted novel, Secret Identity, by Alex Segura. This novel, set in Manhattan in the 1970s, is both a period piece about a crucial turning point in comic history and a murder mystery. The book ingeniously weaves the comic discussed in the story into the pages of the book we're reading. The book's protagonist, Carmen Valdez, is a young Latino woman moving through the comic book publishing world where not a soul looks like her, whether at the workplace or on the pages of the comics she loves. She gets a break to write, but must go unrecognized for her ideas in order for the comic to come to life. A comic is born, trouble ensues, and a mystery begins. Valdez is both a comic book writer and a sleuth, a completely engaging protagonist who you want to follow to the bitter end. Tonight, we have Alex Segura, its author. He is the author of Star Wars, Poe, Dameron, Freefall, and the acclaimed Pete Fernandez mystery series. He's written a number of comic books, including the superhero noir, The Black Ghost, and the YA music series, The Archies. He'll be in conversation this evening with Steph Cha, the author of the award-winning The Your House Will Pay and of the Juniper Song Mystery. She's both an editor and critic, and her work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, USA Today, and the Los Angeles Times Book Review. Thank you both so much for being here. Welcome you both.
Thank you for having us. I personally am very excited to be here because Alex, you and I have known each other for a long time. And I remember talking to you, like, kind of even when you're like going around pitching this book, and it's just so nice that it's like finally out there in the world. I'm blocking it, but you could see it over there. It's beautiful. I thought maybe we could start by talking origin stories. Yours and Carmen's. I specifically wanted to ask about the kind of path for you and for Carmen from your background in PI novels. This is a book that kind of marries noir and comics, which feel like two big pieces of your career so far. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you came to write this book and how Carmen, may have developed from everything that you've known and written before?
Yeah, that's a great question. And thank you, Steph, for doing this. And thanks to Aloud for having us. It's funny, I didn't really realize it until I was in the weeds writing the novel, but there were three separate ideas that kind of came together, ideas that were dating back to when I was in college. One of my first creative writing classes in college, I wrote a short story about a comic book staffer who uncovers the truth about this lost comic book character. And I never finished it. And I was just like, prose was new to me. So it was very much a kind of bumping into the walls and figuring out what to do. And I think because around that time I was reading Cavalier and Clay with Michael Chabon's fantastic novel, which for me, I love Chabon's work, particularly Mysteries of Pittsburgh. I just think he's such an evocative writer. But I remember reading Cavalier and Clay and feeling like someone had finally written a book for me. It had pulpy elements, it had comic books, it had great literary moments. And the only thing it didn't have was it didn't have the comics that were discussed in the novel in the book. So I felt like I really wanted to read about the escapist and I wanted to see the comic. But I never thought in my wildest dreams that, 20 odd years later, I would be doing a book that way. It was just like you read something and you just wish, I kind of wish it had that too. And eventually they did do them. And then I think when I was working in newspapers before I started working full time in comics, I created a character called the Lynx. That character has isn't really just the name is all it has in common with the Lynx that you read about in Secret Identity. But it's just funny how, you know, I knew, and you and I kind of ran parallel for a long time in terms of writing a long running PI series and kind of being in those trenches. And I knew after I finished the Pete books, I wanted to try something different, and I wanted to try what I thought was a standalone and now is a shorter series, probably not as long as the Pete series, but
That's great.
Yeah. So the next book is going to be set in the modern day, and Carmen will be in it, but she won't be the central protagonist. But you know, I wanted to do something different. And then I was reminded of my favorite kinds of books. My favorite kinds of crime novels are the ones that take you somewhere else. You know, they take you to a different time, to a different industry. Megan Abbott does it particularly well. Like, she will take you, she'll bring in the elements of noir to something like Cheerleading, something that you think would never be noir, but then she makes it work. And I thought, well, there hasn't really been a comic book noir. And that's when I started thinking about that idea forever ago about comic book sequences in the novel. And before I pitched it to Zach Wagman, my editor at Flatiron, I knew that we needed a sample page. So I had the artist like draw a sample page. And so I included the sample with the novel, the partial novel and the outline. And I think that was great proof of concept, but it was, and I think you could probably relate to this too, that moment when you're after you're in the trenches on the series for a long time, you want to level up and you really want to be thoughtful. Not that your other novels were not as good or not as thought out, but I really wanted this to feel much more character driven, much more atmospheric, and less, you know, there's action in the book, but it's not like cars aren't exploding. There's not, the body count is relatively low. It's much more, you're spending a lot of time in Carmen's head. And that was an intentional pivot.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And it's funny. Yeah. You and I have the same editor, you know, Zach Wagman, edited Your House Will Pay also. I knew when I pitched that book and as I was writing it, that I wanted to get people to read it who I didn't necessarily think would touch a PI novel. You know, it's just a kind of different part of the genre. I mean, how do you think about genre, like in a book like this, where you do you, like, cause I was trying to think about, you know, how to classify this one. It's not noir. It's not noir either, you know, and it has a lot of the kind of pleasures of a mystery novel. But you know, I feel like, you know, a lot of people will read this who wouldn't necessarily read, you know, especially like the fourth book in a PI series.
Right. Yeah. I mean, my day job is in marketing. So I think about genre in that space, like what's the age range, what's the genre, how do we shelve this? But as an author, I try to separate myself from that and really focus on what I want. I mean, this sounds terribly lazy, but I only write things that I'm like obsessed with. And I think, I mean, we've talked about this. It's just like, I'm not a great researcher just if it's homework, you know, if it's something I have to do, but if it's something I really want to read about, like, then I will dive in wholeheartedly. And so in the writing of Secret Identity, it became this mashup of comic books, comic book industry novel, a coming of age story to some degree, a story about Miami to New York, a period piece. And it's funny because when it makes any, it's made a bunch of lists, which I'm flattered by and it's amazing, but it's also made lists in every kind of genre. It's been on speculative lists, on sci-fi lists, on noir lists. And so I think that's a testament to how it blends things together. And I try not to overthink the genre stuff because eventually the marketing side will figure it out.
You talked about, I didn't know, I was going to ask you about when the comic book pages came in. Was the one you included in the original pitch, did that make it into the book?
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually hanging, this middle thing is the original art that Sandy did. I mean, you probably can't see it and I don't want to disrupt like the whole thing, but it's in there. It's the one where she's jumping through, let me see if I'm good at finding it, she's jumping through the window.
Shattered glass. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and the one we sent Zach was in color, which was cool, and I think that resonated with him.
So what, can you talk about this process, you know, and I guess like this is where, you know, working in comics before probably gave you, you know, some know-how, like if I wanted to shop a concept like this, I'd be like, you have to just trust that it'll look cool, you know? Yeah. Can you talk about how that came together, you know, maybe the artist that you worked with and, you know, just the process of writing the book within a book, which is, I always love a book within a book. You rarely get to see it like this, you know?
Yeah, I love meta stories like that. I love crime novels that are set in creative industries. You know, there's a great book called Night Film by Marissa Peschel that is,
last year.
Yeah, it's just really dark and noir, but it's not necessarily a noir, but it talks a lot about movies. Elizabeth Little writes, you know, Pretty as a Picture is, you're steeped in film. So I knew I wanted someone, the big thing is I didn't want the comic sequences to just feel like frosting, like, oh, he just put that in there because he works in comics and he knew somebody and they did it and it has no bearing on the story. I wanted it to really echo what Carmen was going through. So you're reading the prose and Carmen is cornered and then suddenly you jump into the comic book sequence and it's a breath of fresh air in terms of the story, but it also gives you a different sense of where Carmen's head was at when she was creating the comic. So I wanted an artist that could evoke the style. Like, I didn't want someone that drew in a very modern style that would just seem anachronistic when you thought about it in terms of 1975. And Sandy is a fantastic artist. I worked with him when I was the co-president of Archie. He did some stuff for us and I knew him from before. And we'd gone back and forth about maybe collaborating on something. And I knew he had a real love for comic book history and the characters in the industry. And I knew he would evoke the style without making it feel like a pastiche or like, you know, anything tongue in cheek. There is one moment. And I also wanted to show the flow of a comic. Like sometimes different people work on a comic and that sounds mundane to me, but there's, you know, a lot of laymans don't really understand that, you know, the comic book author and artist can change from issue to issue. And that could completely be a complete gear shift in terms of like quality, story style. So I wanted to also show like what happens when Carmen stops writing it or when Doug Detmer, the artist who launched the series, what if when he goes away? And so there's a page where you see like two hacks basically take over the book and it kind of shows you the contrast. So Sandy did an amazing job and what we did is we worked, I didn't give him a full script first. We talked about it and I would send him like a few sentences for each sequence and he read the whole novel. So he knew like kind of how the interludes fell in and then he would lay it out and I would script over the layouts and then he would finish it up. So it was much more organic than sometimes you get in comics when you don't know the artist, you have to go full script, which basically means you're describing the panel breakdown and the dialogue all out of the gate, as opposed to, I really wanted him to direct those sequences and kind of use his eye as an artist. I'm not a great artist and I'm definitely not a published comic book artist. So he knew cinematically how to make it work and how to evoke that era, I think he did an amazing job.
I think he did. And that specific page you're talking about with the different artists, I mean, I thought that was so cool to kind of to have that like object in there that really demonstrates, all, you know, I felt like it was pretty essential. Like you did a good job weaving these panels in a way that like really did like elevate the story. And I'm one of these lay people who didn't grow up reading comics, you know, so I wasn't really that familiar with this concept of like, you know, oh, like this issue is a collectible because this and this and this, and like, oh, this was garbage. And like, it really fell off after this. And so that was really interesting to see on the page.
Yeah, I wanted to show the jump the shark moment, kind of the moment where people would drop out because creatively it sank. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned that you're lazy about research. I too am very lazy about research. Okay, so you know a lot about the present day comic book industry. So if I were you, I'd be like, all right, people don't know about the present day industry. I'm gonna blow their minds with like this shit that I see like every day. Like, I'm just gonna put in these little details because it's gonna be the laziest thing. So why did you go with the 1970s golden age? And can you talk about that era and maybe some of the differences between then and now, you know, and this is also like a very specific segment of that era too, where like, you know, she's working at this smaller house that's kind of in the shadow of DC Marvel. And I mean, I was completely captivated by this, by this backdrop. And, you know, so I kind of get like the appeal of it, but I want to hear you talk about this golden age of comics. I also know that Zach is a big fan of this industry, right? And the story.
Yeah. Zach,
the golden age.
Yeah, totally. He's a super, super comic fan. And I remember, I think it was VoucherCon in Dallas. I was sitting there like before catching my flight home, and he just happened to sit next to me at breakfast. And I was just like, this is super awkward, but I'm going to just pitch you on this book I'm working on. And because we were talking about comics for so long, and I was like, if I don't pitch him now, like, I'm going to feel like it's terrible. And his eyes just lit up, and he was like, just tell me, keep me posted, which to me was a good sign. And then, but to your question, I thought it was going to be easier than it was in terms of research. I was like, I know this stuff, you know, I'll set it in the 70s. I can do this. And then, you know, it became a question of, I didn't want to crank it out. I wanted it to feel authentic. I wanted to really create this sense of verisimilitude where, you know, people that might not know a lot about comics could still feel like, okay, this feels accurate. And the people that do know about comics could see, okay, he did the legwork, and this could, you know, if you squint, you could see that this existed and maybe this happened in the way that those meta stories that I love. But the 70s are a particular low point for comics because it, you know, comic shops really didn't start opening up until the late 70s, and comic shops really changed the market in terms of collectability. Before, comics just hinged on the newsstand, which meant, you know, if you went into the grocery store, you got whatever was there. There was no way to say, hey, can you find me the older issue of Amazing Spider-Man, or I'll wait for the next one. There was no real consistency. Whereas, you know, in comic shops, you see those great, huge back issue bins, and you can build a collection and start kind of grading comics and seeing what's valuable. And it was a pipeline for publishers to speak directly to the fan, because in the newsstand, not to get too granular, but with the newsstand, you have to overprint by like 60%. Like you print like 60,000 to sell 20,000. That's those numbers are wrong, but you print much more than you sell. And so a lot of these books were getting pulped. And I think the only people really working in comics at the time, generalizing, were super fans like Carmen, people that were just so passionate for the industry that they wanted to be part of it, or people that were just kind of seeing it as something transitional. Like, I'll do this, and then eventually I'll write my book, or eventually I'll move on to do something else, or I'll get a job at a traditional publishing house. It was not meant to. You know, I think people felt like the Titanic was heading to the iceberg already. You know, it was not a lot of the companies were lucrative. There was no sense of like media exploitation. Not like today where you flip on like Disney Plus and it's all Marvel. It's amazing. Like characters that even when I was a kid were like third or, you know, B or C level characters like Ant-Man. Like he never even had his own comic book, but now he's got his own movie. It's really amazing. We're in this like golden age for like comic book media. And that wasn't even like an idea in the 70s, I think. And one other thing that I found really interesting is that it was also kind of the Wild West, like content wise, because there was no real editorial oversight. You only see that much later when you start to see merchandising, and you start to see the first inklings like the Incredible Hulk show, or like that first Spider-Man show. Like that's when those companies started to realize, okay, we can monetize the IP. But before that, the editors had their own little fiefdoms, and they kind of let creators cut loose as long as they met their deadlines. They didn't really worry about what they were doing because there was no sense of like, oh, you can't do that with the IP because it's going to be a movie, you know? Yeah. And now that's pretty commonplace.
Yeah. I want to go back to talking about New York in the 70s, but something that did pop out at me was, you know, and this is just like a side piece of it, but this idea of IP, you know, obviously no one's saying IP, you know, right. No one's saying like, you know, own, but like you're talking about like ownership of characters, you know, and like there are a couple characters in the book who have like a inkling that like, oh, maybe like it would be worth kind of keeping some of this stuff. And it reminded me of that, like that character in Mad Men who was like, oh, maybe I should like take over the TV advertising department, you know? And it's like, and looking at it now, it's just like, oh, of course, like IP is what matters, you know? But it's interesting to think about comics existing in a time before, you know, I guess like even Marvel is like very recent. I mean, in the MCU, I mean, this kind of large scale takeover of comics. You also kind of hint at the beginnings of like a Comic-Con style gathering, but it's all super niche.
Yeah, I mean, this was definitely before like they call themselves pop culture events now, where you can, you know, see movie trailers or meet actors. And the initial Comic Cons were really just like a bunch of guys setting up tables, selling old comics. Some creators would come by and like kibitz with each other, but it was never like a media event. It was something for the hardcore fans. And even then, even before comic shops became a thing, there were some collectors. There were kids that, you know, you kept the stuff you bought on the newsstand and you traded with your friends, but there was no hub to like buy back issues. It was only just starting. And so, yeah, I really wanted to show that contrast in terms of the comic book industry and of course, New York, how different those two things were in 1975 from today.
I also found the kind of genre conversation within the book pretty interesting. You know, the publisher of Triumph Comics, you know, has these kind of literary aspirations, and they're on one side, he's like, you know, who cares what happens with the comics, because just they're trash anyway. Just this idea, yeah, if you dismiss an entire genre as trash, like you don't care about the actual quality of the trash.
Right. Yeah. That's
where it belongs. But there's also another character, Marion Price, who is more interested in like, you know, in like the side of this kind of niche industry that feels more like kind of graphic novel memoir of today, where, you know, it's not about superheroes, you know, they're telling these more personal stories. And, you know, without getting too into, you know, what happens, and, you know, Carmen kind of becomes involved in that side of things too in the end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just such a tiny part of it, but can you talk about like that kind of divide between the superhero comics and kind of what we see, you know, because people weren't calling it graphic novels back then, right?
But like, right, yeah, I mean, because there was no real, I mean, there were some collections of single issues, but there weren't really like comics in bookstores shelved, you know, in the same way traditional novels are or nonfiction books. And so I wanted to recognize that movement was happening, the indie comics movement, and it was vibrant and important. But I also wanted to write the novel through the filter of superhero comics, which I think to most people is, for better or worse, comics. You know, a lot of people think of comics in terms of superheroes, and I also grew up loving superheroes, and it felt like a nice motif to have the fictional character. But Marion was really interesting because she wasn't, you know, I had not intended for her to become so integral to the plot. Like she showed up in that volleyball scene. Yeah, I love her. And she showed up in that volleyball scene because I needed an ominous like figure pointing at like not everything being great with Harvey.
Yeah.
And then I needed somebody else. And I was like, well, why don't I just bring her back? And then she ended up becoming integral to the plot. I'm not going to spoil anything, but I also wanted her to represent kind of that comic book vanguard, like, you know, the West Coast, a little like defiant, a counterculture figure that, you know, she doesn't represent everyone that was working in indie comics at the time, but I wanted to have that voice in there. And I think she was a lot of fun to write.
And she's a lot of fun to read. Okay. So going back to New York in the 1970s, because mm-hmm. that's obviously another big component of, you know, the book setting. And I imagine that took a lot of research too, because I know you live in New York now, but New York now is very different from what it was in the 70s.
Yeah, it's so, so different. And it's funny because when I first started writing novels, period, I was like, well, I guess I'll write a New York PI novel, but I didn't feel ready to do that. I didn't feel ready to write like a Matt Scudder novel or anything that would evoke the city because I had just moved there. But I think after five crime novels and a Star Wars novel, I was like, I think I'm ready, but I don't want to write New York today. And so the idea of writing in comics of the 70s really resonated with me. And one book in particular, aside from like, you know, perfunctory research, like what happened on this day and, you know, how do the streets intersect or what were the subway lines back then, was Will Hermes' Love is a Building on Fire, which is his like musical history from the 70s through the prism of him growing up in New York. And so he talks about obviously CBGB, you know, Max's Kansas City and all those evocative like punk rock places, but also Latin music and jazz and the avant-garde. And I found it really fascinating. And that really gave me a lot of textural sense in terms of like what references to use. And, you know, CBGB is a plot point, but hopefully not in a heavy handed way where it just feels like name checking.
No, it felt a lot of fun. It felt like it was a lot of fun. And I enjoyed, you know, Molly, the roommate who I like that. That was kind of a mini arc within the book. You know, it was never central to the story, but the idea of like the New York roommate who you kind of find a little bit randomly, who like, she's just like kind of guarded with and becomes like a close friend. This is just a total side note, but I just really
That
evolution of a female friendship, you know, that's kind of smoothly slotted into the book.
Oh, good. Yeah. I love them. I love their dynamic.
She's great. You know, she's kind of our point of entry into that music world. And I thought it fit very naturally, you know, their professions kind of played off against each other in an interesting way.
Oh, good. Yeah. I mean, Molly is so fun and she doesn't really humor Carmen's defenses. Like Carmen has her shield up most of the time, but Molly finds a way to crack through them. And that happens to everyone. I think when you move to New York, you end up being roommates with complete strangers because that's how you do it to survive. Like I know I did in my early days. So
I also wanted to talk to you about this concept of a secret identity, which is definitely a comic book concept. But you know, Carmen is also, you know, she's Cuban American. She is from somewhere else. She's from Miami. Mm-hmm. You know, she's kind of blending into this city. She is, you know, somebody at the office and she's somebody at home. She's also gay. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about how interesting it is that like the superhero genre is full of these, you know, very heavily white, straight male figures who have to adopt a secret identity, but like it's generally people who like probably aren't used to adjusting themselves for everyday life. Whereas Carmen really is. And I felt like that was just such a, and you never come out and say this, you know, that's just kind of, you know, like what I kind of was reading from the book, like very, you know, it was very deftly done. Can you kind of talk about that concept? You know, obviously it's important. It's the title of the book, but that it kind of sits at the intersection of, you know, superhero comics and, you know, just larger questions of identity.
Yeah. I think, you know, Carmen, she just, in the way characters, the best characters do, just showed up and I knew who she was. I could see her. I knew what her background was. I knew her personality. She's so unlike my series character, Pete. She's very driven. She's very put together. She's very, you know, naturally motivated. She doesn't have the same demons he has, not to compare and contrast, but I really like the idea of secret identity as a title because, you know, she pours her heart into this project because it's her dream. She wants to achieve this dream of creating this character. And she's got her defenses up for various reasons. She's got her defenses up because she's in a new city. She's got her defenses up because she's like coming out of this, big issue with her family and has to escape a toxic relationship back home. And so her shields are up and she's kind of become something else. I think at the end of the prologue, she says, I have to become someone else. And I wanted to evoke that sense of hiding yourself, hiding your identity and projecting something else, which is the character. She creates this character and that's kind of, you see little bits of her that maybe she's not showing as fully in the prose. And that took a lot of work because, I mean, I wanted to be really thoughtful about it because I'm always curious when people write outside of their own experience. And I think it's important to really like be transparent and thoughtful about it. So I obviously had a lot of beta readers in terms of people that worked in comics that were women around that time, but I also had, you know, sensitivity readers to make sure that I wasn't being like, you know, that I was in the right wheelhouse. And I was like being, you know, I wasn't trying to tell a definitive story of that experience, but I was also trying to be as true to it as I could be, you know, being a straight man, you know, but also being thoughtful about it. And that was challenging, but I also didn't want to back away from that because I was scared, you know.
She's such a great character. I mean, just a really wonderful, fully formed character. You know, and obviously, like her secret identity. I mean, she's not really closeted. You know, it's like it's kind of she's not like super out there, like, you know, sharing it openly all the time. Right. Or anything, but like, she's not closeted. That's not the conflict of the story. The conflict of the story is that she literally has a secret identity as this ghostwriter.
That's the secret, that she's written this character that is such a part of her, like the links. Like my favorite scene of the book is when she's brainstorming with Harvey, in terms of Carmen, when she's brainstorming with Harvey the first time and Harvey kind of comes in and is just like, well, what are we going to do? Like has no point of reference or any ideas. And she busts out these notebooks and she's like, we're going to do this. Here are my scripts. And his eyes bulge open and he's like, wow, you're really like prepared. And she's like, I've been working towards this my whole life. So I really wanted to emphasize that this was an important thing for her. And so when she loses control of her character, she's like losing herself. Like she's given up her identity. So she has to kind of become someone else to reclaim it. Yeah. And that to me is the turning point of the, that's kind of the title in a nutshell where it's reflected in the book.
Yeah. It also feels like a really fun version of the broader conversation that we're always having in literature about like cultural appropriation, like who gets
right.
whose story. And, you know, it's kind of a conversation that like I'm personally sick of because it yeah. comes up so often. And I thought yeah. that this was such a like fresh way to kind of, because you're kind of obliquely talking about that, you know, but like, it's really just like a literal story of, you know, not outright theft. She's part of it. She, you know, this is like her way of getting her voice out there. But, you know, it is this story about this kind of tension between art and ownership and,
right.
you know, how much does it matter, you know, whether your name is on the book, you know, obviously we care, you know, so
yeah, I would like my name on my book.
Came out. Can you talk about that idea, that kind of concept of art and ownership and, you know,
because it is
a big theme of the novel, you know, it kind of runs throughout and it's something that, you know, I found consistently fascinating and, you know, there's just so much juice there.
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful question. And it is something, it is definitely a kind of a meta conversation about character ownership, intellectual property, creation, and who owns what. I mean, comics historically is littered with stories of creators that were not credited properly or did not receive the proper remuneration for how their characters were exploited. I mean, I could rattle off like 15 names, but in kind of revisiting those stories, there was a commonality that I found. And I mean, the best example, I guess, is like Bill Finger, who co-created Batman. He literally wrote all the initial Batman stories. He created a bunch of the characters with Bob Kane, but for whatever reason, because the artist had basically taken credit for his work and gone to DC and signed a contract, his name was lost to history. And it's fascinating and it's tragic. And he only recently gained credit. Like, so now it's Bob Kane with Bill Finger, which is amazing. But so I wanted to evoke that without being too heavy-handed. And I wanted to really show kind of in a nutshell what it means, what creators pour into this process. Like she basically pulls out a piece of herself and puts it in this comic book and then it's lost. It's immediately lost. And so I wanted that sudden feeling of disconnection. And I knew that was the only thing that would propel someone like Carmen, who's very, I wouldn't say she's a rule follower. I would say she's very diligent and organized and probably would not have gone to the lengths she did if it hadn't been something seismic like this, something that really uprooted her. Sorry, there's like all these trucks going by. New York City.
I have a toddler who occasionally you can hear in the background. I wanted to talk about the character of Harvey Stern. I thought the way that you treated him as an author was very interesting and kind of deft because he's somebody who, he's in the position of the guy you hate. And he does a lot of things that you're like, oh,
yeah,
this guy, you know,
not a great guy.
No, he's not a great guy. But Carmen consistently describes him as her friend. And, you know, she cares about him. She cares about kind of things. She cares about him. And like her care about him and her friendship with him does become like one of the drivers of the book. And you know, she's very forgiving of him, you know, probably more so than like I would be. And for those who haven't read the book yet, I know it just came out, you know, Harvey is the character who goes to Carmen and suggests that they write something together, but his name goes on the cover because, you know, her boss is totally dismissive of her spec scripts. And she kind of takes the opportunity because she thinks this is her one shot. To get her creations out there. And so he's exploiting her. She is getting something out of it that she wants. But she's very consistent about, you know, she has mixed feelings about him, but she's very consistent about acknowledging those mixed feelings rather than just writing him off completely. And I thought that tension between the good and the bad in his character and the way that Carmen treats him was pretty interesting for, especially for a character who, like, you know, he's just like immediately cancelable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. A couple of weeks ago, I was on a panel about villains and Secret Identity came up, and I basically said, I don't think there, I mean, there's obviously a murder and a crime happens and that person is bad, but I think everyone else is pretty complicated and it's pretty gray. Like, people make bad decisions and maybe aren't bad people. And I think Harvey to me is fairly tragic in that, I was thinking about this today, like, if the story was from his perspective, it would just be about him like trying to jump the line because he feels he's entitled to this opportunity because he is who he is and he deserves it. So why wouldn't he just like put his name on the book? And I think what makes softens that is that he clearly has some affection for Carmen, sometimes expressed poorly and expressed rudely, but he clearly cares and he's conflicted because he wants to do the right thing. But he doesn't want to do the work to get to it. So I think if he was kind of a better person, he would write his own scripts and he would have just done the assignment and or put Carmen's name on it. So, and Carmen's equally conflicted in terms of how she responds to him because she does feel bad for him on some level. Like, when they meet, you can tell that she knows he has a crush on her and she knows that he's desperate to write. And so she wants to forgive him, but there's also a few points in the novel where she kind of breaks and she's like, he betrayed me and I need to, like, now I need to empower myself and figure out what happened here more for myself than to really figure out what happened to him because he kind of screwed me over. And so that push and pull was interesting to weave through the book.
And can you talk about the links? Because I think, like, you were talking about that scene where they're kind of putting together her character. But, you know, I found her pretty compelling and I like understood why she hit. And I think that Carmen understands why she hit, whereas all the people she works for are like just happy to take in the money, but like,
yeah,
they don't get it. You know, can you talk about, well, first of all, I'm curious about what your original Lynx was like. You know, what is it that drives the Lynx? To what extent is she a Carmen alter ego? You know, what makes her such a unique figure in this comic book world?
Yeah, that's it's interesting. When I knew I was writing this book and I knew the Lynx was going to be the character, I started going back and reading a lot of comics from the 70s or rereading, but also spending a lot of time with comic book, you know, female superheroes of that era, especially, you know, like Spider-Woman or Mrs. Marvel or Wonder Woman, and kind of seeing what worked and what didn't work or just what the tropes were. But I also wanted to show a character that was street level, kind of like a Daredevil or a Moon Knight or a Batman type hero, but was a woman and was not, didn't fall into the cliche buckets. And I think that's where Carmen kind of nudges the character into that direction, because Harvey's initial thought is like, well, she has to like be suffering from some great tragedy to be propelled into being a superhero. Like, he wants to do it paint by numbers. And Carmen's like, well, why does it have to be that way? And I think usually in those situations, the other person will ask, well, what do you know? You're not a fan, but Carmen is a fan. Like, she knows the tropes probably better than him. And so I wanted Carmen's influence to kind of be the nudge that elevated the links beyond just the churn that Triumph is putting out. And so to me, it was also like, what character would I want to read about, you know, in that vein? And what are the stories that are interesting to me? And I'm always interested in character-driven stories about duality and about some level of like vengeance. But I also wanted her to feel different. I didn't want her to feel like a run-of-the-mill superhero, and definitely not a one-for-one to Carmen. I think there are things the Lynx does that Carmen would like to do, like, you know, like, that's, the claws are a very metaphorical thing. Like, she clearly wants to, you know, be more, I guess, vocal or active, but I didn't want it to feel like just a one for one, like the Lynx is just Carmen's like alter ego.
Yeah. I think that's how I often feel about, you know, kind of, you know, like my, I don't know how you feel about Pete, but, with me and Juniper Song, it's like, yeah. Oh, there's like an alter ego element there, but like there's some element of fantasy too, of just like, oh yeah, like I would totally be this badass in this situation.
Yeah.
I think it's very, it's
yeah. I mean, that's the fun part about writing a Private Eye series is you can punch that guy instead of like being mad about it later as you drive home, you know, like.
I am curious if you'll start hearing from comic book fans, because as you pointed out, they are like, that is like a big fan base, and they will like call you out on stuff. I'm curious if you get any emails and what those emails would even, I wonder if like there are any nitpicky emails you're going to get. I can't tell. To me, the book, you know, the book is perfectly researched and every detail is in the right place, but
I hope it is. Yeah. I mean, I spoke to a lot of people, like I spoke to a lot of women who worked in comics at the time to kind of run the idea by them and say, is this not just the murder, but the idea that someone could write a character and not get the credit. And, They said it was plausible, and that was helpful. And I also talked to a lot of people that worked in comics to kind of fact check it. And that was helpful in terms of like, oh no, sales reports would take longer to come in, or maybe they're using this kind of ink when they're mocking this up, or like these are, they're, you know, like something like the copier would have been a relatively new invention, and this is how it would have worked in a comic book company. And just like those little details, and also the historical references to make sure that I was in the right headspace. But I'm sure there'll be something. And I mean, at least as far as what I've seen, the comic press has been very positive, but you know, I'm sure there's some little mistakes.
We're going to open it up to Q&A in a couple minutes, but I wanted to ask you one last kind of two for question,
okay.
Which is so I wanted to know what you're working on. It sounds like maybe it's this next book that is in the same universe. But also, I guess I don't know if we have any writers in the audience, but you know, you're somebody who has, you know, this is not your debut novel. You're someone who's in the game. You've done a lot of different things. You know, you came from kind of the small press world, and this is kind of a breakout book. And I mean, I feel like we've known each other like at least on Twitter for like almost 10 years now, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious if you have advice for kind of authors on just career longevity and management. Like there's never any guarantee that the breakout book is coming, you know? How do you kind of assess how things are going year to year, and what can you do to get your work to the next level? I guess that's kind of a broad question, but
that's a really great question. I mean, like we were saying, we were chatting before this started, and I was on a list like, you know, breakout novelists, and my first thought was like, this is my seventh book, like, and it sometimes it takes seven books to break out, and that's fine. Like I wrote five novels for an indie press, and they were well received and they got nice attention, but you're still like, the machinery is not there to kind of get you out. And I think at the end of the day, which when I'm feeling my most serene, I'm happy that I'm doing this, and I probably would do it for fun. Like, which sounds a little like new agey, but I think you have to really like tap into the passion for it. And then, you know, the rest is very much out of your control. Like I'm lucky because I have a publicity and marketing background, so I'm able to kind of analyze that part of the industry a little more closely than maybe some authors. But, you know, I always try to go in with zero expectations and be, you know, it's all about the work. And I think people celebrate the victories too much and bask in the lows too deeply. And I think you kind of have to try and plateau it as much as you can, because there's no singular moment. It's a marathon. Like getting an agent, that doesn't mean you're going to get a publishing deal, or getting a publishing deal doesn't mean it's going to be a bestseller. And, you know, and it's kind of taking those wins and celebrating them and recognizing them, but also realizing it, that it's, if you want to build a career, it's about the long game, which sounds Machiavellian, but it's really just, you know, you just have to be a little bit more level-headed. And do the work. That's the hard part. I think sometimes people get distracted by everything else. And at the end of the day, it's the thing that's going to matter the most is the book. So.
Yeah. I want to hear about what you're working on, but maybe we'll end with that.
Okay.
So now we're going to open it up to Q&A. I see there are already a couple in the Q&A box. So we'll start with those. But if you all who are listening have questions, please feel free to put them in the chat. So this is this question is from Molly Unger. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. If you had one, what would your secret identity be?
What would my secret identity be? I don't know. I mean, here's a little secret that some people probably picked up if they've read the book, but there are like Easter eggs, not just to comics, but to other things I've written. So like every like comic book I've written and created is somehow referenced in the novel. So you see like little nods to the Black Ghost or the Dusk or things like the Freedom Alliance. So, I mean, I even threw in the name of my old like band, like that band that Carmen and Molly see at the beginning. Oh. Like that was the name of the band I played in like in my 20s when I had time to be in a band. Like it's not like an exact description of that, but you know, I think we have to do stuff like that to make it fun for ourselves. Like Juniper shows up in a Pete novel, like the email, and you know, like little things like that, that maybe nobody else would care about, but it's a trip for me. So I don't know. That doesn't really answer the question, but that's what struck me.
Okay. How about, okay. So do you have a favorite comic book series character and why?
You know, I was, Spider-Man's probably my favorite. He was the first superhero character I picked up as a kid. And it was like an old Stan Lee, John Romita comic book that featured the Green Goblin. And I was probably way too young to have read it. Not too young, but it was just like, I remember being terrified by it. I'd only been reading Archie comics, which were very like safe and funny and sitcom style. And that was my first superhero comic. And after that, he kind of became my guy. Like I was always like, even if I was collecting other comics, I'd always come back to Spider-Man and kind of see what he was doing. And I'm still like that today. Like I try to keep up. And there's this future version of Spider-Man called Spider-Man 2099, not to get like too in the weeds, but it was really important when I first discovered him because he was Mexican-Irish. His name is Miguel O'Hara. And I remember picking up the first issue in middle school and just being so awestruck to see like a Latinx superhero, because that was not commonplace when I was a kid. I mean, there were some characters that were, you know, Latin or, you know, but it to think that there could be like a Latino Spider-Man was so evocative to me. And I was like, wow, that's possible. And that's kind of why I created Pete. And I'm sure why you created your character. It's like you want to see yourself out there. You know, I was kind of tired of seeing like the Latinx sidekick. I wanted him to be the PI. And now it's great because it's part of the conversation. But I think maybe when we started, it was less so. So
yeah, I have a theory about why some of us who've been around for years are suddenly having breakout novels like in the last few years. But
I hope it's not a trend.
Yeah. Jorge asks, if your story was set in modern times rather than the 70s, would it change a lot? And would you ever write the story set today? I mean, I know that you have, but you can.
I think I initially toyed with the idea of setting it in the modern times, but I also wanted to use the knowledge of today and kind of filter it through the past. And that's why you have like, I don't want to spoil the book, but there's like little nods to like what comics are going to become. And I felt that added a layer of fun to the book. Like you were talking about Mad Men, that moment where you're like, okay, yeah, you should work on the TV accounts. That's going to be a big thing. But you know, I guess I can get into what I'm working on next. Like the next book in this sequel is set in the modern day, and it features a new protagonist. Carmen is a factor in the book, but it picks up you know, where Secret Identity left off, but obviously some years later. And it follows a cartoonist who once wanted to draw superhero comics, but for whatever reason didn't find a path. And so she became, I guess, a magazine illustrator, like doing cartoons for like the New Yorker, you know, like a Julia Wirtz type cartoonist that, you know, gets a lot of mainstream acclaim, but also has this like fondness for superhero comics. And there's a social media wave, or I guess campaign, to get her to work on this newly relaunched character, you know, this relaunch of this very obscure character called the Legendary Lynx that had been gone forever. And so she takes the assignment because she loved the character as a kid. But as she starts working on the gig, she starts getting these anonymous messages. These anonymous messages basically hinting that there's more to this character than you know, and the ideas you have about who created it are not true. And so then, you know, Carmen will become a factor. And I don't want to say anything too much, but that's kind of the setup. And it's been interesting because now, you know, the novelty of writing about something in the 70s is you don't have cell phones, you don't have social media, like you can go off the grid, and research is a whole different beast. So now I'm kind of trying to lean into what it is to be writing a noir novel in the modern day.
Yeah. How far into this are you?
I'm about like 30,000 words into it. So, I mean, it's outlined. I have the whole thing plotted out. So,
okay. That's great. So when do you think this is going to be out, in like 2 years?
I think next year, if I step on the gas and I feel like it's in good shape.
Okay. Someone asked, you said you've been writing this book for a long time. How long did it take you?
I spent a lot of time like in the idea space, which I think, you know, one of my pet peeves, and I don't know if you share this, is the whole like word count. I call it the word count mafia, this idea that you have to write 1,000 words to like call yourself a writer. I feel like when you're thinking about a book, or when you're doing research, or you're talking to people, or I make a lot of playlists. I make music playlists to kind of like get my brain going. So I knew Secret Identity was going to be the book when I finished Blackout, which was my fourth novel. And so I wrote two novels kind of while thinking about Secret Identity. So I've been working on it for a long time, but in terms of the writing, I probably wrote it in, I would say, 6 to 8 months of like, just, you know, nose to the grindstone, putting words on paper.
6 to 8 months. All right. That gives me hope. And you have two.
Yeah, you can do it. Yeah. It's hard. It's hard. How do you get it? How do you get any writing done? Like,
oh, I don't. I have my kid is almost two. I spent a year, because he was born 3 weeks after COVID hit, or after we went to lockdown. And so, you know, I basically lost a year where I was just doing freelance stuff, and now I'm doing TV stuff. So it's just like, I want to write another book, but it's easy to not write another book.
It is easy.
Other stuff instead.
Do you have an idea, or are you other books?
I do, but nothing that developed. So I'm like perpetually jealous of people now who have books coming out. And I'm like, oh, I want to be there, but it's going to be another couple of years at least.
That's okay.
Okay, I think we have one last question, which is. Do you think the resurgence of comic books in mainstream media was in part propelled by the rise of the graphic novel as a genre, like Watchmen? And what your thoughts are on the comics versus graphic novel split? I'm going to add in my little follow-up, which is, do you think that this is similar to the genre literary fiction split?
Yeah, I think it's just two words for the same thing. A comic is a graphic novel, and a graphic novel is a comic. Like, graphic novel became fashionable as a kind of more buttoned up way to say comic book, and maybe people didn't want to say comic book, but it's really the same thing. And I think you saw a huge uptick in awareness of comics when they started to get collected in trade paperbacks. You know, when you saw something like Watchmen, which was acclaimed but ran over 12 issues, finally collected in that one seminal volume and selling, or graphic novels like Mouse, things that felt quote unquote literary, but, you know, could also be shelved in bookstores. It opened up a whole new audience. It opened itself up to casual buyers, to people who maybe didn't want to go into a comic shop, or like didn't know how to navigate a comic shop, but would be fine like picking up a Spider-Man graphic novel. But to me, the terms are interchangeable. And I do think that was a key moment in the history of like graphic novels, particularly like the mid to late 80s, when you see stuff like Watchmen or Dark Knight Returns, or, you know, the indie upswing with Love and Rockets and those kind of titles. Yeah, I mean, I think anytime comics expands into a new market, it's always helpful. Like, there was a digital boom, like maybe like 10, 12 years ago, when it became, you know, much easier. People started reading comics on their tablets or their phones. And so for me, it's always like, how can we make these stories more available and more accessible to people? Because that's what's really going to resonate. You know, I think the one benefit of having comics on newsstands is that anybody could get one. Like, I got my first comic at a pharmacy, at a drugstore, and I got most of my Archies at a grocery store. And I think that funnel is a little bit loss. You know, not everyone goes to a bookstore, but everyone goes to a grocery store or to a pharmacy. And I think, you know, anything that can adapt or pull in new readers is a great method for comics.
Well, I hope that this new book, you know, it teaches people something about this world. And, you know, I found it so incredibly immersive and exciting. And you know, just congratulations. You wrote such a wonderful book, and I'm glad that
people... Thanks, Steph. That means so much, and I'm so glad to do this with you. I mean, I love your writing, and we've been friends for so long, so this has been special. Thank you.
Thank you both so much for being here, and thank you for that wonderful conversation. And thank you all for being here tonight to watch these guys. This was just terrific. Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
I just want to wish everybody a lovely evening. And also say that next week on Tuesday, the 22nd, we have another program. And for me to go into a description of this program, it was a partnership that we have with KPCC. And it deals with many aspects of Los Angeles and Los Angeles communities. And we have Josh Kuhn, who is a professor at USC in cultural studies, discussing these various programs that we have done with KPCC over the last month. But thank you too for being here this evening, and thank you all for coming, and have a good night. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.